We're recording this for people who can't be here, and also it's a mic. So, thank you for coming, everyone. Hi. It's a great turnout. You've all been contacted because you've got excellent marks, for which, well done. No, seriously, that's a big deal. My name is Tamsin Peach, and I run the Centre for Public History here at UTS. And I grew up in Adelaide, and I was very fortunate to get a Rhodes Scholarship back in the dim dark days of 2003. But I grew up in the country, I was the first in my family to go to university, I had no freaking idea what the Rhodes Scholarship was at all, but I really, was a bit of a nerd, and I did really well in my undergraduate degree. And one of my professors tapped me on the shoulder and said, you should really think about this thing called the Rhodes Scholarship. Have you ever thought of studying abroad? And it was only that made me start to think about what opportunities there would be beyond Adelaide. And it was the thing that changed my life. So when I moved back to Australia, I did that about 3 or 4 years ago. One of the things I wanted to do was to help broaden the profile of the Rhodes Scholarship. Because for 100 years, the scholarship office has been based at University of Sydney. And not surprisingly, for 100 years, University of Sydney have absolutely dominated the selection process, the successful candidates. Really, 80% of applicants were from University of Sydney and New South Wales. I think it's only a handful of people who, until recently, who weren't from the University of Sydney winning. And I think that's largely to do with who knows about it and the kinds of support that you get in applying for it. So I've taken on the role of the New South Wales Honorary Secretary, which means I manage the whole scholarship scheme and organise the selection process, convene the selection committee, and at UTS I'm available to answer questions and to sort of help people learn a bit more about what the process involves. If you've got a dad who's a judge, or you went to Sydney Grammar, chances are you know somebody who's on the scholarship and that they're going to be fine. So this is one of a series of talks we're doing at universities all over New South Wales. Now hopefully some of you have looked up either this site, which is on the UTS website, or if you're especially clever, but I know you all are because you all did very well, you scrolled down. And you clicked on this document here, which takes you to the Rhodes House website, and you can select your region, which is Australia, and then you click through to the information for candidates document. There may be students here from other universities than UTS. Are there? If you are, put your hands up. Welcome, excellent. You can come and talk to me, but there are also contacts here. Where are they? There are contacts. Come and see me at the end because there is a contact at your university to support you as well. So I can't, it should be on this website somewhere, but we can talk about that later. So who has seen this document? Okay, this is absolutely your first port of call. Thinking about what the scholarship involves. So go home tonight and look at this document, but I'll talk you through it anyway. Let me give you a bit of a background for the Rhodes Scholarships and why I think they're an amazing way to think through what you're going to do with your life. 100 years ago, Cecil Rhodes, he was a big fat racist, really, earned all his money, exploiting black labour in South Africa, mining diamonds, invaded a country, thought that was a really good idea. Founded a scholarship, which was to bring people from all over the world, then it was the British Empire, but it has broadened significantly in the last 50 years, to Oxford, and it, initially of course it was men, but since the 1970s it's included women, to undertake 2 or 3 years of graduate study at Oxford. Oxford is one of the most remarkable universities in the country. Everybody in the world, everybody lives within a small radius. You're based in these communities called colleges, and it is the world-class institution with incredible lecturers. So half of what's incredible about Oxford is the education you receive, it's the content of what you learn, But the other half is the people you meet and the experience you have and the chance to get involved in a whole set of things which will extend what who you think you are and what you think you can do with your life. So it's that dual package of benefits, I suppose, that the Rhodes offers you. Because one of those, and the second part, includes meeting Rhodes Scholars from all over the world. And 100 Rhodes Scholars every year are selected from everywhere, from China to Namibia, Palestine, and of course Australia, the US, and elsewhere. So it's a really rich experience. But in the years since the Rhodes Scholarships were established in 1903, a whole set of other scholarship schemes have been instituted, many of which are modelled explicitly on the Rhodes. So the Fulbright is one of these. Senator Fulbright himself, after the Second World War, was a Rhodes Scholar, and he set up a scholarship scheme directly modelled on the Rhodes. More recently, the Monash Scholarship, which is based out of Australia, which is only for Australians, is also modelled on the Rhodes criteria. So if you're thinking about the Rhodes scholarships, what you're doing is thinking about all those other ones as well. Because the Rhodes has some weird selection eligibility criteria, which are not applicable in those other scholarship schemes, and there are more. So if you don't meet the age criteria, don't worry, you should listen to what I'm saying anyway, because it's directly applicable to the Monash, which has exactly the same selection criteria without the age exclusion. So, and I can talk to you about all those other scholarships as well. So, let us turn to the eligibility. Does anyone have any questions at this point? Closing date is 13th of September. That is very important, at midnight or 1 minute before midnight. And I highly recommend that you submit it before then, because the website has, you know, it's only so good at dealing with lots of traffic, and you don't want to be panicking. So eligibility criteria. These are these four points at the top here, which you probably can't read because it's okay. So you must be an Australian citizen who's been resident in Australia for at least 2 of the last 10 years. If you're the citizen of a different country, you'll be eligible to apply in a different Rhodes constituency, which is great. So go to the other bit of the website, of Rhodes website, that's relevant to you. You must have completed at least 2 years of schooling at an Australian secondary school. If there's anybody that completed 2 years of schooling at an Australian secondary school overseas, because whatever reason, that should render you eligible to apply in Australia. If you haven't done that, then again, send an email to Simone and we'll assess your case. This is the tricky bit. You must have reached your 19th birthday, which I think everyone's probably fine at, but not past your 26th birthday by the 1st of October 2020, which is when you'll start in Oxford, which means you must have been born after the 30th of September 1994 and before the 1st of October 2001. So if you were born on the 1st of October 2001, you're not eligible. If you're born on the 2nd of October 2001, you're not eligible. It's a hard and fast rule. That's why I say the Monash just doesn't have that rule. So you should apply for the Monash instead. Now, some of you might have 2 or 3 years of eligibility left based on your age. I highly recommend you come and talk to me if you're serious about this now, because thinking about this as a 2 or 3 year time horizon is a really good thing to do. So I'll be hosting one-on-one sessions on the 31st of July, which is, I think, next Wednesday. So you can come and see me after the session, or email me and we can make time, or you can just drop in. And we can talk about that. And then the fourth criteria, eligibility criteria, is academic achievement. And this is a bit complicated. Now, you've all done really well, but the requirement is that you need to have an Australian honours degree, which is an AQF framework level 8, or a master's level degree, which is a level 9 or 9E. And there's no one here doing medicine, I don't think. Some of the outside UTS people, no. So with a proficiency of first class honours or a 6.75 grade point average in your master's degree. And you only need to have completed that degree by the 15th of June 2020. So that means if you're currently enrolled in like a two-year master's program and you're in the final year of the two-year master's program that will finish at the end of this year, you will be eligible because you'll have that degree before the 15th of June 2020. You won't have your marks yet, but you should have marks from last year, and there are ways we can deal with that situation of not having your marks. But you will have to have done well in your undergraduate degree at a grade point average of 6.75. So if you're doing honours this year, that means you're eligible this year for the same reasons. Does anyone have any questions about that? Because that can get a bit complicated. Yep.
So I'm doing a master's right now, but I'll finish December next year.
Next year.
Yeah, December next year.
So 2020.
Yeah.
So you wouldn't be eligible to apply this year, but you would be eligible to apply next year, as long as you meet the age criteria. Yeah. Yep.
Do you know what the, because you test us that you can get like the 4.0?
Yeah, it's a complicated formula, but there is one. So we can work that out for you. It's about 3.7-ish.
So I'm doing my honours at the moment.
Yeah.
We wouldn't really get the proficiency level, like whether it's first class,
yeah,
until after we apply.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, so that a lot of people will be in that situation. And what they do is they ask, so we'll come to referees a bit later. You'll have a proficiency level for your undergraduate degree, which will matter.
Sure.
But they'll ask your referees, one of whom should be either the dean of your faculty or somebody who can speak with knowledge based on your expected performance.
Right.
So they will, you'll ask your referee to write that in the reference that they write, and
yep,
that will be taken as a predicted mark.
Okay.
So a lot of people will be in that situation. But if you have 2 or 3 years left of eligibility, it might make sense to think about applying next year or the year after instead. You're only allowed 2 applications of the roads. A lot of people apply twice because you learn a lot from the process. But you might like to just think about the strategy if you've got some time up your belt, because you could also do some things in the next year that would strengthen your application. So these answers to questions like this are on this page, which you all have got in your email, in the FAQ section. There's millions of them. We've been asked every question under the sun. So have a look at that as well. So that's the eligibility criteria. Is there any other questions about eligibility? Which just means, if you don't meet those 4 criteria, no one will ever, I will take your application out of the pile and it won't be read because you're not eligible to apply. Yep.
With the masters and the equivalent mark of distinction, does that mean bare minimum 75 average for every class you do?
It will turn into your GPA. So yeah. I mean, distinction is different marks, isn't it? Yeah. And that's actually for this reason, because it's about, you've got to get into Oxford. So we'll award you the scholarship, but it's terrible to be awarded the scholarship and then not be admitted to Oxford. That very rarely happens because of these, I mean, it hasn't happened in my memory, but because of these conditions. Okay, any other questions?
Right.
We can come back to anything. Hi, take a seat.
Hello.
Oh, and there's the 5th. You must not apply for the roads more than twice. So we'll scoot down to, you have to submit all this stuff, which is pretty self-evident. You copy your passport, your birth certificate to prove your nationality, a transcript from your university. Sometimes important, if you don't have one of them, to start now, because it can take a little... UTS is pretty good, but sometimes it can take a while to get that out of a university. Proof... Yeah, I think it asks you for proof of schooling, which is your SACE... I went to school in Adelaide. It's called a SACE... What's it called here? HSC certificate, yeah. You don't need to worry about language proficiency because you've got a degree from a New South Wales institution. Okay, a curriculum vitae, a head and shoulders photograph, and a personal statement. So it's these two, the CV and the personal statement, that will take up most of your time and that I'm going to talk to you about now. They're really important, like really important. Now, before we return to them, I'm going to scoot down to the selection criteria, which should be here somewhere. Sorry, this is probably making you all sick. Making me sick. Here. Right at the top. So, selection is based on these four criteria. Academic excellence, which is, we've discussed that as part of your eligibility, but if you have won things like the University Medal, or the Dean's Prize, or any other academic awards and recognitions, that makes you a very strong candidate, and you should absolutely highlight them on your CV. These three criteria are expressed in the terms of the will, so they require a bit of translation. Energy to use your talents to the full, as demonstrated by mastery in areas such as sport, music, debate, dance, theatre, artistic pursuits, or anywhere, anything where teamwork is involved. This used to be sport, right? In the olden days, you were like, when I got to Oxford, my supervisor said, so are you a sporty one or a clever one? What do you say to that? So it's not sport anymore, but it's all of these things which I like to think of as extracurricular activities. The actual terms of the will, which can't be changed, says to show you're not a brain on a stick. You know, you're more than a mere bookworm is the term. You're more than a mere bookworm. And the energy bit is important, that you've dedicated time, real time and mastery to those pursuits. Now, they do not have to be sport, but what is interesting about sport is that it shows the following things. That you can work with other people, in team sports particularly, that you've got discipline and dedication. You can get up in the morning and go to training even when it's cold. You can lose and do it again. You've got passion. And you've got physical stamina, but you can demonstrate physical stamina through all those, the things I just mentioned. So if you've been in, if you've played music in a band or an orchestra, if you've, I don't know, written stuff in a creative writing context, artistic pursuits, all of this is counts as extracurricular activities. So this is the kind of stuff that you should think about, but also come and talk to me about if you're unsure. What something adds up to. Yep.
How is that stuff submitted?
It's all evidenced in your personal statement and your CV. So I'll talk about what you make that look like once I've gone through these criteria. Any questions about that strange? Yeah?
I'm sorry, how recent would the sporting be?
Yeah. So on the one hand, I mean, you can go back to high school, but on the one hand, you've got to show dedication, right? Which means that doesn't last for 1 year. You didn't just take it up in the last 12 months, and you didn't do it 5 years ago when you were in high school. So, you know, often people do really well, say, for a time, and then they continue the sport, perhaps, but at a different level, because other, you know, it's the final year of your exams or something. But it's that evidence of performance at a high level, but also dedication, because that sort of highlights your question. Okay. Truth, courage, devotion to duty, sympathy for and protection for the weak, kindness, unselfishness, and fellowship. This I think it's helpful to think of this as the community service criteria. So this shows that you have been involved in doing things for the public, for your community, could be local, could be much bigger than that, that are not just about your own self-interest. It's not just about fostering your career development or similar. So people do all sorts of things in this category, and often they do overlap with their academic expertise. So you might the president of Engineers Without Borders, the university chapter of Engineers Without Borders, and doing an engineering degree. So it's not that, that it can't be complementing your academic pursuits, but it's much broader than that. Last year, a student came up to me. She says, "Oh, look, I think I meet these other three criteria, but I just don't think I've got any community service." And I said, "Well, what did you do last weekend?" She said, "Oh, look, I don't really have time to do anything at the moment because, I'm basically running the rebuilding of my mosque." What? She's like, "Yeah, people don't really speak that much English, and I'm having to do all the liaising with the contractors and organising all the site development stuff." I'm like, "Lady, that counts." So community activities, church activities, whatever you do that is not extracurricular activities and academic activities can count in there, including paid work. If the paid work is working at McDonald's, it's probably not going to fit that criteria though. So we're also talking about what a strong application is. So again, these are sorts of things we can talk about after I've done number four. Number four is instincts to lead, leadership. And I kind of think this has got two elements. One, it's doing these three things in a leadership capacity. So you're captain of your sports team, you're running the film society, you're starting up a new enterprise for homeless kids to make, you know, do community gardening in your local suburb, something like that. That's leadership. That's one element of it. The other element of the leadership is that you've got a vision. And this is the thing that will play a really big role in your personal statement, so it's really worth listening to. You've done a whole lot of stuff in your life up until now, including your degree and including all of this other stuff. How does that form part of a story that keeps going? So what are the challenges? What you need to be able to articulate are the challenges facing our communities at a local level, at an Australian level, and at an international level. And how are you going to be part of meeting those challenges? How is everything you've done up until this point in time evidence to the selection committee that they should invest this enormous amount of money and opportunity in you because you have got a vision for what you're going to do with it? And that does not mean that you need to have like a year-by-year career plan and have what job you're going to do. But it does, because, you know, life happens and stuff changes. But it does mean that you can articulate big questions and articulate your relationship to them, that you're doing stuff for a reason rather than sort of responsively. So before we go and talk about how you might evidence all of this in your personal statement and your CV, does anyone have any question about any of those four selection criteria? Yeah. Oh, they're all.
Aside from the whole everything must be well balanced.
Yeah. So I think the academic excellence is a necessary but not sufficient criteria. So they'll tend to look at academic excellence, your marks, and you don't all have to be, you know, you can be standout in the other three and meet the eligibility criteria in it. But the marks are important because that's what will get you into Oxford at some level. But these are all really and equally important. And part of the difficulty of the roads is that communities are balancing them against each other. I can't answer that question. Yeah. Which one was that in? As demonstrated by mastery in areas such as sport. Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. I mean, obviously it depends on what you're talking about, but have you played sport at a representative level, at a state or national representative level? Yeah, so at the top. Now, I know many of you may not have played sport at a representative level, but this is where the balance question is really important, because You might have had extended sport participation and been kicking it out of the ballpark on the other three criteria, and that's probably good, yeah? But that's what mastery would be. Like, have you played in New South Wales Children's Orchestra? I don't know what that's called, Youth Orchestra. Were you selected by competitive bodies to, be a standard bearer of some kind? Did you run 7 marathons in a year and come in the top 10, beating your personal best every time? Yeah? But as I say, not everyone will have done that, but they might be really exceeding in the other three criteria. So don't feel, oh, I haven't done that, I've got to leave. But you can leave if you like.
It's not related to this current point, but you mentioned that the level of achievement must be significant because they're going to invest all the money.
Yep.
How financially does it look? I know it's not, but it came to me and I am afraid I will fail on it.
Okay, so what the Rhodes cover, what a Rhodes Scholarship covers, is international student fees plus living expenses for 3 years in Oxford. Now, that's quite a lot of money. I think that's probably $100,000 a year, maybe. Depends what degree you're doing. The degrees all cost different amounts. Depends what college you live in. The college fees are all different. And depends what the exchange rate is. So but it's quite a lot of money for up to 3 years. And if you've got a partner, your partner can go too. So, and there's a visa, and your student visa expenses. So it covers all their expenses of life and study in the UK for, now don't quote me on that figure, please, because that is just a total guesstimation. But it's not an insignificant amount of money, and it's also a significant opportunity. The selection committee is chaired. Pardon?
I'm staying here.
You're staying here. The selection committee is made up by the Governor of New South Wales, or chaired by the Governor of New South Wales, and 6 or 7 community leaders from across the state. So there's a lot of people with serious jobs spending time thinking about your applications. So it's serious. But UTS had never had any applications, let alone a scholarship, until 2 years ago. And 2 years ago, a UTS student won the Rhodes Scholarship. So I think our students are as good as any students from any other university. It's just that I think probably we haven't been used to thinking about ourselves in these terms. So that's the point of this whole exercise. And last year we had 4 students in the final, were interviewed. 4 students. That's well above the percentage of students that UTS educate, that graduate from UTS. There's 1 for New South Wales, there's 10 for 9 for Australia, so there's 1 from each state and 3 federally. So what that means is each of the states select 1 scholar and then they recommend a second, sometimes they recommend 2 additional to go to Canberra where there's a second interview process. So this one is selected. And then 1 or 2, depending on what the committees think, who they think are competitive, get sent to Canberra, and there's another application process in which the numbers 2 and 3 from across Australia come together for an additional 3 scholarships. So that's a pretty good chance. No, it is. 50 people from New South Wales applied last year. That's a pretty good chance. Pardon? Well, not if you count the other 2.
Yeah.
So New South Wales also won the national scholarship last year and the year before, because we have a lot of universities. So it does tend to be Victoria and New South Wales that dominate in the national competition, because there's a lot of strong candidates and there's more students than that come from Tasmania. So any more questions before I talk about the selection, the personal statement and the CV? Oh, good question. Yeah. I mean, Oxford teaches a lot of things. And I'm glad you've looked at some of the courses. Many of the graduate level programs are 1 year master's degree. Is that what you were thinking of? Yeah. Often students do one of two things. What I did was I did a 1 year master's, and then I enrolled in the PhD program, which takes 3 years. So you'll know that 1 + 3 = 4, and the scholarship only covers 3 years. But Rhodes have an arrangement with Oxford in which you don't pay student fees in your fourth year. And there are quite a lot of scholarship schemes like really available to support your living expenses in that fourth year. So you can make it work. And Rhodes will help you make it work, right? Rhodes House. So that's one option. You do a 1 year master's degree, and you do well in that master's degree, so you decide, I'm going to continue on to do a PhD. Or, and a lot of people do this, you do 2 1-year master's degrees, which is also really great, because there are a lot of very interesting master's degrees. And if you come to me and go, oh, I do this thing, I'm interested in this, but I don't think Oxford teaches it, I bet I'll find you a 1-year master's degree that meets your needs. And it might be that you've got to think a little bit creatively about that, because what is the point of, how does Oxford fit as part of that narrative about what you want to do with your life and what challenges you want to meet? It might be that by doing something a little bit broader than you initially thought and matching it with something specific, that makes you someone quite special to meet these community public challenges that we've been talking about. That's a good question. There are one or two restrictions on degrees you can't do, because they're really, really expensive. And they are all answered here. Somewhere here, anyway. There'll be a question about what you're not allowed to study. It's the MBA and the MPP. You can't do them together. But check that out. Any other questions before we talk about the personal statements? So, oh yeah.
Would somebody be able to go and study something that they've never studied before at Oxford?
Potentially, yeah. You've got to make a good case. Can somebody study something that they've not studied before? So that's not totally out of the question. A lot of people, particularly from India and also from Australia historically, went and redid a second BA. And there's one second BA at Oxford that's very, very famous, and it's called the PPE, the Politics, Philosophy and Economics degree. And basically everybody in the Tory party cabinet has done the PPE. And if you've done a bachelor's degree in anywhere, and done well, you get to take off 1 year of that degree. So it's a 2-year degree. And that's very popular. So often people have got no background in that, and they go and do that. But it's also possible in the master's degree, as long as you meet the eligibility, you know, your eligibility criteria, you don't need specialised knowledge. Economics is sometimes hard because there needs some maths proficiency, but, yeah.
Sorry, I have another question.
Okay.
Is it full-time study?
Yes, only full-time study.
Only
full-time.
So if someone studies here and works here at the work district in Portland, and there is a
No, it's only full-time studying. Yep. People obviously work in the summer, right, when university stops, but it's only full-time. So there was a question behind.
Just 50 people apply. How many go to the interview process?
Yes, a good question. So there's 2 rounds of interviews. There's a long first round and a second round. 4 people are at the second round. But because it's sort of up to the selection committee how many make the long list, make the first round. It's usually between 8 and 12. Depends on the government schedule too. We've only got 1 day. Yep.
Are there any trends in terms of the subject areas that can get awarded resources?
But that's mostly because of the applicant pool. So the applicant pool from New South Wales, I only know the New South Wales data. The applicant pool has been, well, can anyone guess what 2 degree programs, courses, make up 70% of the applicant pool until last year. Medicine and law. Medicine and law make up 70% of the applicant pool. But so they have dominated the people awarded because that's the kind of people that have been coming to interview. But part of this whole process is to change that, to change those stats and widen them. And there's nothing in the selection committee that necessarily want to select people in medicine and law. God knows we've got enough of them, right? So I think if anything, there's a desire to elect other kinds of scholars. So, you know, we don't teach medicine at UTS, which rules that out. We do teach law, but a lot of our law do joint degrees. So, yeah, it's a good question. Sarah, another question? Okay. So we can come back to all of that. Just shoot your hand up if you've got any questions. Now, I'm just going to go back here to the three selection criteria. CVs, very important. Do not include a picture of yourself. You've sent that in anyway. What needs to happen in your CV is that you make it as easy as possible for the selection committee, who are reading an enormous number of applications, to assess you against the selection criteria, which means put them as major headings on your CV. I cannot emphasize this enough. I don't want the same CV that you submit for work, for example, or for internship. This is a different kind of CV that you need to remake for this purpose. So at the top, we want your academic achievements. That means the degrees you've done, the dates from which you graduated, the any awards you've got, GPA, put them all up front so it's very easy for the selection committee to see, tick, you've done, you're stellar. Then I would literally put three headings. One, which is you might call energy and extracurricular activities. Second heading, the third heading, would be community service. See where I'm going here? And the third might be leadership. But what you would need to do under these two headings is show leadership, right? And then list it by in reverse date order so that your most recent experience is at the top and put your dates down the left-hand side and then, you know, the information that follows. Captain. Under 21's New South Wales hockey team. And the date might be 2017 to 2018 because you were for 2 years. Now, under those major three headings, one, two, three, you might have subheadings. You might have sport, artistic pursuits, right? Music. You might have done more than... It should make that... Lay that out so it's really clear for the selection committee. And of course, you can put other stuff in there, but make sure you've got those three headings clearly definable and that you've got something in each of them.
Just curious, in a lot of resumes or normal CVs that you submit, high school typically doesn't count for the general one. They would want to be on your CV. On the roads, would you say it's allowed to feature?
Definitely put it on there. Say again?
It was mentioned as a criteria that they did.
Exactly. It's an eligibility criteria that you've been to an Australian high school. Put it on there, but also include the stuff you've done at high school in those lists. So it really helps to know what school you went to. It's not a selection criteria which school you went to. But, you know, until this year, your school principal used to be mandated as a referee. So that's just to say that they're interested in what you did in high school.
Yeah. So is it still good practice to reach out to your school principal as a referee?
If you think that's a particularly meaningful relationship, potentially yes. But you've got 5 referees, we'll come to that and it specifies how many academic and how many speak to your character, your other pursuits. So you've got to kind of use them quite carefully to think about who's going to speak to which bits of your profile. And a school principal is a hard one because they're not really academic and they're not really character. They're probably character. So you've used up one of your character references on your school principal. Does that make sense? So if, I don't know, if you've been going back and coaching the rowing club at your high school, or you've been running a tutorial program at your high school in your spare time as a volunteering thing, then it would make a lot of sense to talk, yeah, but, yep.
When we're writing the actual content under each of these headings, how detailed and like what kind of language should we be using?
You don't like want it to be a whole paragraph, but you sometimes need to give one sentence of context, right? So particularly, I don't know, someone got to the final round and they played in the Australian League. It's called Ultimate Frisbee. But, like, the governor who used to be head of the Australian Army has no idea what Ultimate Frisbee is. So, you know, you need to kind of put a sentence in there explaining that a little bit. And the names of the Ultimate Frisbee teams are kind of weird and don't reflect that you're actually playing for New South Wales. Right? So stuff like that is important. But, you know, you also... There is a page limit. Yeah. I can't remember what it is. It's on here somewhere. So, there's a page limit on the, there's a word limit on the personal statement. I don't think there's a page limit on the CV. But you also don't want to piss your selection committee off, right? It's like essays. Some of you have probably been assessed by essays. You kind of want to make it easy for your marker to give you a high distinction. So don't, like, they're all reading it, three glasses of wine in on a Friday night when they'd rather be watching Netflix. Yeah?
I think it's 3 pages for the CV.
3 pages. See, she's read.
I think.
Straight to the finals for you. Okay. Does it say it there? 3 pages. Do not include a photograph. Okay, personal statement. This is the really important thing. You can read all this, it's on the website. Address your general interests, what inspires you, discuss your aims and priorities, tell us your reasons for studying at Oxford and what you want to do, demonstrate your aims to meet the entry criteria. If you want to do a PhD, you have to submit an additional brief of your proposal, of your research proposal. Does anybody want to do a PhD? Yeah?
What if you're already accepted into a PhD position?
That's fine, apply it, right? Yeah. We need to talk about the PhD in a minute, so remind me to talk about that. It's a bit, doing the master's first and transferring to a PhD sort of solves a lot of problems on one level, but a lot of people do go straight to the PhD, so that's fine. So there's this. Your personal statement has to do a lot of work. It's got to convince the committee of this story I talked about, and it's also got to brag like crazy. But you've got to do a bit of humble bragging. But it's still bragging, yeah? So we need to know how amazing you are academically, but we need to know how that sits within the broader picture. So what are your passions? What is motivating you to apply for the scholarship? What are those challenges, those big public challenges that you think we all face? And why are you impassioned to do something about them? That's a great way to start. And then you want to sort of zoom back and talk about how all those things that appear in your CV, how that evidences your passion for this thing. Now, of course, you don't have to have known since you were 6 that you wanted to be a cardiac surgeon and change the world by doing heart operations in Penrith. Right? There's lots of circuitous routes, but you've got to tell the story of those circuitous routes. Sometimes we do something and it's a really transformative experience and we learn something from it and it causes us to change tack. So if that happened in your life, tell that story, right? It's persuasive, it's real, it's not confected, and that's also how the people on the committee have lived, you know. And that might have occurred during your time at UTS, that might have occurred in your high school years, that might have occurred in your personal or family life. And then situate the sorts of things you've done with your time, the commitments you've made, in the context of that story. Telling us what you learned by leading, what you learned by captaining, what you learned in the orchestra, what you learned running, setting up a film society at UTS, why you thought that was important. And then make sure on the second, you know, the last page of your, what's it called, the personal statement, you might have like three paragraphs to do these jobs. Tell us how Oxford fits in that story. So what degree you're going to do. If you're doing a PhD, you might make contact with your department already. You might say that. You might name drop somebody that you really want to work with. Say how and why that is an impressive and important part of your story, what it will change, and then what you want to do with it, right? So why do you want to do, I don't know, having done a health degree at UTS, why do you want to do an MBA? And it might be that you've got a vision for developing a new product that you've been working on in your honours project that, you know, there might be a reason for that story, but it's got to be a story. And then end on something that's a bit bigger, right? It's your vision for the future. And I say that in a kind of, it's concrete. It's not like I'm going to save all the whales. But you might want to be a marine biologist, or you might think that what climate change needs is somebody that can make persuasive cases in particular communities. So you might have a sort of specific version of the save the whales. You have Diana. So, does anybody have any questions about Ashley Lee's honours? Yes.
Is there an element to they want to get the most influential people to qualify so that later on Rhodes Scholars have a higher gravity to it? Is there something about that in this process?
Look, I think probably historically that has been the case. Right, and if you go to St Paul's College up at University of Sydney, there's an honour board that's a mile long and it's got Michael Turnbull on it and a whole bunch of others. But the scholarship is really trying not to do, like, what, and I certainly don't fit that profile. What I think it does is it gives you the opportunity to be influential, which is why they want really to invest in somebody with integrity, with passion, and with a public spirit and vision, and of course achievement, can do all the stuff. So I really don't think committees think like that anymore. And I know because I'm picking the people that serve on the selection committees. So no, not anymore. But you're right, you're not silly to come to this with that set of assumptions. There was other hands.
What's your story?
Yeah, what's my story?
I'm so curious.
Yeah, it's okay, yeah. So I grew up in the country in Australia as part of a very small German religious community, and I went to Adelaide University, which meant moving out to Adelaide, big city of Adelaide, where I lived in the seminary, because that's the place my parents would let me live. And I did an arts degree because I really loved history and literature, and I just sort of did well at that because I really loved it. Really, I was a massive nerd. But I was very involved in the student society while I was at university, and I sort of ran it. And I played sport, I played hockey for South Australia. And then I went to Melbourne, and I got the university medal, which some of you. I had no idea what the university medal was. I was living in Melbourne and I got this letter and I opened it and I had to ring up the university and say, what's the university medal? I can't be at the ceremony to accept it. Does it mean I don't get it? And I was working. So I took a job because I love books. I thought, oh, I'll take a job working as a saleswoman for a publishing company. So they gave me a big Ford, and I drove around Australia selling books on frogs to Dimmicks, you know, Wodonga, which was very dispiriting because you might as well be selling toothpacks, you know, it was not funny. And I thought, oh my gosh, I probably can do better than this. I wasn't very happy. And I saw an ad in a newspaper, in the Asian newspaper, in the Times when jobs were still advertised in newspapers, to be aide to the governor of Victoria. And that was usually a job that was done by military, but they, the first year they were opening it to civilians. And what the aide did was he organised everything that the governor did. Wrote the governor's speeches, lived in government house with him, at the time it was a him, organised every event, including the visit of the President of Greece to, you know, the opening of Sunshine TAFE. It was an amazing job. And as this girl from the country, and I think I got it. I think something like 500 people applied for that job, which is why 50-1 odds is good. I think I got it because I was interested in the world and I was really engaged in ideas. And that's ultimately what they wanted. And in that job, one of my jobs was to run the Rhodes Scholarship selection process. And my professor had mentioned it to me back in the day, and I'd kind of forgotten it. And then I got to Rhodes House, then I got to Government House and I was running the selection process. And all these people applying, and I had to read their applications. And I was like, I'm as good as these people. So I put an application in. In Adelaide, you know, not in Victoria where I was working because that would have been a conflict of interest. And I didn't get it in Adelaide. I got sent to Canberra, where all the good people get selected. And I was lucky to get it in Canberra. So that time at Government House totally changed my life because it made me realise how the world worked. I was like this tiny little hick from the country. It was wonderful. But what I said in my application, which is maybe what you're actually asking, was that I wanted to run a museum or a cultural institution. Because I thought the ways that we make meaning about the world around us were absolutely integral to the kinds of societies that we build. And that shouldn't just be something that people can do in universities, that should be something done in public. Accessible by everyone. So I went to Oxford and I did a master's in history. Oh, I said, what I want to do is a master's in history and a PhD in history. Now what happened? And they thought that was good. Then I wanted to come back and run a museum. I still might do that. What happened was I did a PhD in Oxford. I did really well in my PhD and I got a postdoc there, which is also very hard to get. And so I stayed on for another 3 years. Then I got an academic job working in London. And then 10 years passed, and I won a grant from Sydney University to come back and spend 3 years here. Still had my job in London. And while I was back in Australia, I fell in love. So I decided to stay. So now I'm back running the Australian Centre for Public History, which does a lot of work with museums and art galleries and public cultural institutions, and I get to do a lot of what I said I thought was important. So that was my personal narrative. It had quite a few circuitous turns, and one question I got asked in the selection committee, I'll never forget this in the interviews, was this is this classic select. You know, like interview question. So write this down. Like, you know, I reckon 50% of interviews you get asked this question. What's the best mistake you've ever made? And I said, taking the job for the publishing company. Because although I spent 2 years driving around Australia in a Ford Falcon, which was pretty dispiriting, I learned a lot about Australia, but I also learned my own value. And that has been a real grounding for the decision to do other things. Any other questions? Yep.
Just inspired by the interview question. Accepting the fact that the odds are fairly decent, what can you do to prepare for the interview?
So if you get shortlisted, if you get longlisted, if you get to the first round of interviews, myself, together with a few other people who have run scholarships and done these things, will do a mock interview with you. So let that be a problem for them. Yep. What I'm here to help you do at this stage is to prepare your CV and your personal narrative as well as you possibly can. And after you've done that, once you've got longlisted, then we'll get to the next stage. But I said I would talk about PhDs. So with a PhD, you've got to provide an additional proposal for your research, and this will be used it's used by a selection committee to assess your cred, basically, whether you're serious, but they're not able to make disciplinary specific judgments, but it will be used on the basis of entry to Oxford. And one of the things you can do there to help the selection committee is to show that you've been in touch with the potential, with the supervisor you want to work with in Oxford. So it does pay to make contact or to attempt to make contact. And if you've got a professor here who knows someone there, that's a really good route in. And often what they'll say is yes if you get the scholarship, right? Because they're not going to pay for you out of their funds. But you can then say, I have made contact with Professor Important Face, who is the leader in microbiology, blah, of pants. And, I'm really interested in his research too. It's good to do some showing in this bit here that you have a specific knowledge of what you want to do at Oxford. Any other questions at this stage? Who's feeling good about this? Yeah, good. This is a very wonderful and difficult thing to write, this personal statement. But have a go at it, because it will really help you concentrate your mind on what your life's about. And that's what's really beneficial about it. And come and talk to me about what your life is about. That's what I'm here to do. And I also want to say some other things that are very important. And that's about people who have more than 2 years of eligibility, more than 1 year of eligibility. So if you are eligible to apply next year, it really makes a lot of sense, and you'll see this already, I hope, to think about it now. So to think of it, because there might be some things that you could add to, you could use your time differently. Often I've said to people, go away and, are you into water conservation? Go away and join the land care, right? So there might be bits of your CV that are really good and bits that could be strengthened. And if you've got 2 or 3 years, now's the time to do that. And if you want to have a chat about what would be best to invest your time in, come and have a talk to me. If you need to work to earn money, also come and have a talk to me, because there might be some jobs that can fit this story better than others. And you don't, just because you get paid for it doesn't mean it's not part of the story. But as I said, McDonald's is pretty hard to fit into the story. So that's something also to think about. And think seriously about this at this stage. And one of the things that might happen is that you apply this year, it's not successful, maybe you even get to interview and you get some feedback from that interview process, and you can go away and do something about that in the years to come. But at the same time, if all your activities start in 2019, the committee's going to go, it's a bit odd. So it's also about linking it to an ongoing story, the new investments that you're making. Yep.
Referees.
Yep.
How much does the status of a referee matter?
Medium to, sometimes yes, sometimes no. What really matters is that the person knows you well. You're not allowed to have anyone who's related to you write a reference, right? That's stipulated on that form. What you should all have is the dean of your faculty write a reference, or the head of your school. Now the deans, oh thank you, the deans have all been clued up about this. So it's not that, you know, you should approach your supervisor or your head of department or your head of school and say you're applying for the Rhodes Scholarship. And in effect what might happen, so, is that someone who you know really well, one of your lecturers, would maybe help the dean write the reference. But you should also have, in addition to the dean or the head of school, your supervisor of your honours project, or somebody that knows, that's worked with you on an extended basis in a research project, and maybe somebody else. But you need usually three academic references. You've read the details more closely than I have recently. It's three academic references and two character. Yeah. So thinking about who those referees are is also, there's a whole other document on here on Notes for Guidance about referees. That's really important. And the reason that the dean or the head of school has to be there is because they can do these things we were talking about. They can say, and they will explicitly be asked these questions by the referee, by the reference process. Does this student appear in the top 1%, 5%, 10% of their cohort? Does this student appear in the top 1%, 5%, 10% of all the students you have taught? So they are the people that say, I expect this student to get the top honours in his year. I'm just going to ask this guy a question first. You had your hand up?
Oh, I was just going to ask about character proposition practices in particular.
Yep. I mean, come and chat to me, because there might be some options there. If you've like started a company with somebody or something, then you might have a co-founder, and it might be that that person's appropriate to write a reference. But it might also be that there's somebody else that we can find that can speak to that work by thinking a bit creatively. But if it's your sport coach for the sport is always an example, or the head of the I always make this crap up, but the head of the orchestra, the head of the New South Wales Writers Association or something, there's someone applied last year and they've written a novel. They got the person that had awarded them the scholarship, the sort of prize for writing the novel to write the reference. That was really good. Community service, it could be the pastor at the church, or sometimes people have worked or volunteered for their local member of parliament, could be a member of parliament, but it could be something quite, you know, small fry. You might run you might be really involved in the community garden, and it's the person who chair of the community garden committee, or Climate Change Balmain, you know, the guy that runs Climate Change Balmain, who's just Joe Bloggs, really. But there's somebody that knows you and the work you've done and can write fulsomely of you. Might be your school principal if you've done a lot of, I don't know, coaching or something for the school. You've had a good go, we'll come back to you.
Is everyone he invited to attend this meeting?
Yeah.
Who, by whom, how did the process make you select?
Are you here applying on behalf of a student?
Yes.
Okay, so you're not a journalist, that's good. So because I think one of the bigger problems that places like UTS and other, you know, universities, and I've recommended that all universities do this, so this is not specific to UTS, is that our students don't know about the scholarship, and if they do know about it, they don't think they're eligible. They rule themselves out. So what we did was we worked with the data from the Graduate Research School, and we contacted everyone that got first class honours or a preferred. So everybody who met the academic criteria that we had information for, we contacted and wrote to them. And then we wrote specifically to people that had won the University Medal. Now, there might be some of you here that are in your second year, But you were you appeared on that list because the deans nominated you, or there was some other process by which you were selected for your academic achievement. Precisely because we think you should know about this, and we think you should start thinking about yourselves as eligible for it. Now. Yep.
Based on UTS.
Based on your UTS results. You had a question.
I was actually going to ask the same question.
Oh, good. Yeah, but you were at a different university.
Yeah.
So, well, the same thing would have happened there.
Are there similar programs like this one for the Fulbright and Monash, or could we also do that for you guys?
You can come and talk to me about that, particularly the Monash. The Fulbright has... Actually, the Fulbright office for New South Wales is also based at UTS, so I can put you in touch with that person. Because the Fulbright, but I can also talk to you about the Fulbright. The Fulbrights are slightly different because you've got to kind of match with a specific institution to work with, and they have to agree to work with you, and it's just a slightly different setup. But yes. I mean, it's an interesting. Sorry?
I think I might be in the same boat as that guy who left quite early.
Yeah.
I think I'll stay around.
Yeah, no, I think it's good. And the Fulbright, it's not cool. The Fulbright has come. The Rhodes. Secretariat came to UTS last year, the Fulbright's come this year. These are not coincidental things. So there is an effort by UTS to invest in the academic excellence and it as a home for academic. These things were previously at the University of Sydney. So this process is designed to capture all of you and funnel you all towards those scholarships. So I'm really glad that you've stayed, because a lot of this is exactly relevant for the Fulbright. You'll have to tell a story.
Because we don't have to have principals as a reference anymore, and because you emailed out everyone who got a certain mark, do you think that you're going to have way more than 50 applicants this year?
Well, we emailed everybody last year.
Oh, okay.
And so the applicant rate went up, well, nearly doubled last year. I think that there might be a few more than 50, but probably less than 70. I'd like that to be a lot more. I know that reduces your chances, but then you wouldn't be here if I hadn't done this process. So, you know, six of one, half a dozen of the other. And I'd also love the applicant rates to go up for those other scholarship schemes. And there's others too. I've mentioned there's the Schwarzman, which takes you to China, and there's others. So don't, you know, this is part of a package of scholarships, and it's really time that we stormed them. Yep.
Just going back to the registering
question.
Yep. Five.
You have to have five.
I know it must be five.
That's correct. Yep. And you need to have three academic. And there are some people who may be crossover. You might have, I don't know, done something with one of your professors that might also count as extracurricular service. They're really great people because they can speak about, if you're like president of something, you know, at university, if you run a club or society or something, it's quite nice. Sometimes you can get your professor to speak a bit about that. It's quite good.
I think you mentioned something earlier about spouses coming with you.
Yeah.
What's the deal with that? Is that like study or is that just
oh, no,
to
go? They are allowed to go. They they'll get a visa. That means they can work, and there are some colleges that have couples accommodation, so they essentially get free accommodation. They don't get entry to Oxford, but that does mean that you need to. The college stuff, just don't worry about that, because that all comes after you've been awarded it, right? It's really not. But there are some colleges that you should apply to rather than others, because some colleges don't have couples accommodation that I would be able to recommend staying.
Really dumb.
Nothing's
done. But for the honours component, does it have to be based off research, or could it be subjects? Or because you can get your honours here through doing subjects.
I think you came. No, it could be whatever honours,
okay.
Whatever way you get your. I think you came late, and we asked the question whereby. No, it's okay. Some people might still be doing the honours this year, so they don't have their marks yet. But that's where you get your referee to predict your marks. Still makes you eligible as long as you have it before July next year in hand. Yep.
What have you done really well in your postgraduate? You're on
How, well, it depends how iffy, but look, that should be okay, because again, it might depend a little bit on what your story is. Some people have really bad shit that happens to them, right? And then you turn it around, and that's part of...
And this may be your strength.
And that might be your strength, yeah, that's part of who you are. But you've got to have an explanation for that, and you wouldn't just pretend that didn't happen in your personal statement, you would talk about it specifically, yeah? So failure can be okay, but you've got to accept not an actual failure, you know, because then your GPA tanks. But you know, and what that would show to me is that you either were doing the wrong subject or something happened, but you've had the real dedication and passion to take off once you hit your straps. Yep. Yeah. Are you in your second year or?
No, I'm in master's, so you're mentioning how if you have.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, look, it's not going to be. Don't take this as an indication of your predicted marks. It's based on marks awarded. So you probably did quite well in your undergrad degree, or your entrance marks for. Or your entrance marks for the masters were good, or you were nominated by somebody, your dean or somebody put your name on this list. So some of this is based on, fascinating why you care about that. The reason you're here is either because someone nominated you, and if you don't have a mark yet from UTS, that will be the reason. Because you've got a good mark from UTS, yeah? You can assume that your predicted marks do.
But if you've already completed the degree...
If you've completed the degree, yes.
Oh, okay. Yeah, because I was trying to work out that, as someone mentioned before, UTS goes by, like, the GPA before.
Yeah, you can...
That
look, they haven't done the calculation for every student in the university to convert it from 4 to the 6-point, 7-point GPA. So it's in the ballpark, yes. You would need to, you're in the ballpark, but you would need to check specifically that you meet those eligibility criteria. I know this is a bit hard, but because there's, 40,000 students at UTS, what they did was they took the top cohort from all of the degree programs with a degree as a proxy for people who have done well, right? So that was first class honours or other measures, GPA measures. But because the GPA is at a 4, I think they pick people with 3.7 above. I can't remember what the conversion is because it's a weird algorithm based on your subject weighting. So you're in the area. Yes. Lights have gone out. Any other questions? Yep.
You mentioned university members. How big of an advantage is that?
Massive. I mean, look, you're not going to, it's not going to guarantee that you get it. I mean, if you don't have the university medal, you're not going to not be in with a chance.
Yeah.
But it really, it makes you stand out. So that's a great thing. And you should be proud of getting the university medal.
I feel like a trend of people who apply for these are people who are interested in, like, public policies, human rights, and culturalism, and all that. I did IT.
Yep.
Would that still...
Guy last year won it, but I did IT.
Okay.
Cool. Yep. So you just, you know, you can still care about the world.
Yeah.
You know, IT for good. I don't know. Come to talk. I know some of you are getting a bit, like, ready to go, but before you go, just to reiterate, I'm available to talk to people one-on-one next week on Wednesday 31st. I think 31st is Wednesday. Email me, Tamsin Peach, it's on the bottom of that email, or email Simone, Rhodes, New South Wales, to make an appointment. You could try chances rocking up, but I think there'll be people with appointments. And I'd love to see them. But also feel free to come and talk to me now. Is there any other questions before the court gets? Well done for being here. It's really good. Great.